and welcome to the American Security Project. We're a bipartisan group examining some of the big national security issues facing our nation. Today, we will be brought to you by the hashtag NatSecASP. We're joined by James Kitfield, a senior correspondent at the National Journal. He's written on defense, national security, and foreign policy issues from Washington, D.C. for over two decades now. He's won numerous awards, including being a three-time winner of the Gerald R. Ford Award for Distinguished Reporting on National Defense. Most recently, in 2009, for his first-hand reporting on the Afghan War and other ongoing conflicts and threats. His books and articles are a must-read for anyone who wants to understand national security and strategy. Today, he's here to discuss national security in an era of global upheaval.
You know, I have argued in my writing that the post 9/11 wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, have already had a huge impact on America's trajectory. Before these wars, at the beginning of this past decade, I was writing articles about the post Cold War period being a historic anomaly, where we were a unipolar moment, where we were alone atop the international order as a lone superpower. We had the world's preeminent military, a robust economy, a budget surplus, if you can imagine that, only 10 years ago. And our influence in the global diplomatic scene was unmatched. You know, just 10 years later, no one talks about America in those terms anymore. Nobody. I mean, no one who looks at strategy or looks at the strategic environment talks about that America in those terms. We're in a very different place today. And while we were mired a decade of war and a great recession, China rapidly accelerated its rise, primarily because it was not the you know, developed countries were not affected as much by the financial meltdown as developed countries. Along with Brazil, India, Indonesia, Turkey, the BRICS are clawing their way to the top of the international system and insisting on all the privileges that come with that, but paying very few of the cost and shouldering very few of the responsibilities of maintaining that global order, which is still falling disproportionately on America's shoulders. We've seen that globalization and the political empowerment that comes with that is sweeping out the old world, the old order in the Middle East. Islamist forces have come to the fore in Egypt and in Tunisia. We've seen that this dynamic in the Middle East now is giving a lot more room to maneuver for Islamic extremists like Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. The revisionist powers like Russia have not, as we had hoped in the 1990s, you know, joined the international order as a sort of a stakeholder, as we had hoped. And the perennial outliers like Iran and North Korea sense opportunity in this moment when America is distracted. At home, President Obama faces a $1.3 trillion annual deficit, crushing debt load that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, former Trump chairman, calls the nation's greatest strategic threat. We have a defense budget that's roughly the size of all their nations combined, and a war-weary public that's demanding a peace dividend. And unlike past post-war periods of retrenchment, such as the 1990s, the security threats the United States confronts today are not only multiplying, but they're changing in form. For 10 years, basically, the world's actors have gone to school on us. They've seen where our weaknesses are, and they are devising asymmetrical approaches to counter them, insurgent warfare being the primary one. So what's the strategic scorecard from this decade of very expensive conflict for the United States? Well, Afghanistan, the goal was to destroy Al-Qaeda, topple the Taliban benefactors, and ensure that the government that emerged there was strong enough to make sure Afghanistan would not become a hotbed of terror again. We did largely destroy Al-Qaeda, core Al-Qaeda, that ran across the border in 2001 and resided in Pakistan's tribal areas, killed 19 of the 20 leaders that were on the cards that we gave out in 2001 of the people we most wanted. We did that by special forces, primarily in CIA drone strikes, which I think is the model for the future. But as I mentioned, Al-Qaeda affiliates are finding new places to operate in the post-Arab Spring chaos. The Taliban is back. As we refocused our attention on Iraq, the Taliban was able to regroup. They are back. And in Iraq, the strategic goal was to make sure that Saddam Hussein was never able again to threaten us with weapons of mass destruction. Well, we checked that one, but at great blood and pressure and cost in international prestige. And the second order strategy was to coerce the other Axis of Evil members, North Korea and Iran, into giving up their weapons of mass destruction. It had the opposite effect once we got bogged down in Iraq. They both accelerated their nuclear programs, and we have not seen the last of the pain and the suffering that's going to cause us in the years ahead. So we're confronting a period of retrenchment and drawdown. There's an ironclad rule in Washington that has always held true historically, and that's that when wars end, defense budgets decline. They typically decline by a third, which would suggest that the roughly $500 billion already agreed to cut over the next 10 years is probably only a down payment on the cuts to come. What worries me about periods of drawdown is we usually get them wrong. After every war to end our wars, we demand a peace dividend, and we cut defense too long, too deep, and with the net result being that when we send troops back to fight the first battles of future wars, they usually get bloodied badly. That happened in Kasserine Pass in North Africa at the outset of World War II. It happened at Task Force Smith in Korea. It happened in the Yadrang Valley in Vietnam. The Desert One botched attempt to rescue the Iran hostages that came after the post-Vietnam drawdown was a poster boy for how the Hollow Force Army, how we got that drawdown wrong. And the cycle, I would argue, repeated itself in the 1990s. As we reconfigured the force, drew it down by a third, that force did not anticipate or thwart the 2001 terrorist attacks. And that force, when sent into Iraq, was manifestly unprepared for the counterinsurgency campaign that it needed to wage there. So we get drawdowns wrong. That's one concerning point for me. Another point is that I think this drawdown is almost uniquely challenging from the ones that I've looked at, which include Vietnam and the post-Cold War drawdowns. First, this really dysfunctional partisan gridlock in Washington is going to make managing a coherent drawdown extremely difficult. The poster child for that is this sequestration that we're even at this moment confronting, and if we go over the fiscal cliff, we'll trigger, which essentially is a bipartisan agreement between Congress and administration to hold the Defense Department hostage to their own dysfunction. And if they remain dysfunctional, then they're gonna shoot the hostage. That's how dysfunctional Washington has gotten, and it does not bode well for managing what would be a difficult drawdown at the best of times. Second, the United States is burdened with a far more debt than in previous drawdowns. That means that the temptation to cut too deep and to cut for too long is going to be manifest, and that worries me a lot. Third, because the 1990s peace dividend involved a procurement quote-unquote holiday, we are still living off our arsenal is still living off the Reagan buildup of the 1980s. I'm looking at the same planes and tanks that were, you know, the Army and the Air Force were using in the mid-80s. They had been worn very, very to a frazzle, basically, by 10 years of conflict they did not anticipate. Everyone probably remembers famously when Governor Romney said in that presidential debate that we have the oldest Air Force since 1947 and the smallest Navy since the 1920s. Just because he lost the election doesn't mean he can have a point. He had a point. When I talked to General Denny Reimer about former Army Chief of Staff who managed the 90s drawdown, you know, his comment to me about what to look out for, he says, you know, we were talking about a new world order after the Cold War, but it was long on new and short on order. And that has been, that is even more the case today. The world is at a very transformative and unsettled, chaotic place. And that's going to make managing a drawdown, which is always about balancing risk, extremely difficult. All this says that we need a new strategy for the post 9/11 era, when this world is unsettled and relative U.S. dominance is declining. You know, just as one data point, you know, about that relative decline, I noted that, you know, when I covered Desert Storm in 1991, right after the end of the Cold War, America at the height of its power. President Bush 41 was able to get a UN Security Council resolution for liberating Kuwait. Massive coalition included most of our Arab countries and friends in the Middle East, and we got our allies to pay for it. And it was very successful. You know, compare that to his son's war in 2003, where the UN Security Council denied its approval. We had a coalition that was a mile wide and an inch deep. We had to pay for it. The overwhelming cost of Iraq was on our shoulders, at roughly $1 trillion. And it wasn't short, it wasn't victorious, and it was very long. There's an old military adage, you try to be strong everywhere, you're strong nowhere. So a strategy has to, as I said, balance risk and decide where you need to be strong. On the issue of grand strategy, if I could paraphrase many experts who know more about it than I do, but who I talk to frequently about this, you know, the grand strategy behind the American century was basically this. We inherited it from the United Kingdom, and it was the spread of a liberal international order fueled by free trade and capitalism that played to the strengths of open and democratic societies. That's it. That's our grand strategy. And the hope was always that as your power waned, the international order would be so vested in that grand strategy that you wouldn't have to hold up into the burden of policing it anymore. Globalization, which is probably the predominant dynamic of our lifetimes, has put the grand strategy on steroids. One result is a dramatic shift in relative economic and thus eventually military power from the developed West to the developing East. And managing that will be the essence of any strategy we develop. The result has been a rapid rise in the wealth of developed countries, as we've seen, led by China. In 2008, the CIA put out its forecast for the next 25 years called Global Trends 2025. And it predicted that the international system that we constructed after World War II and led to the American century would be all but unrecognizable by 2025. It predicted that we'd be in a much more multipolar world in which gaps in national power between developed and the developed world and the non-developed world, developing world, would narrow significantly. In 2008, the best minds of our intelligence communities predicted that China would rise to be the second largest economy in the world by 2025. Well, China did that last year. 15 years ahead of what our best minds thought was going to happen just, 4 years ago. Again, resulting primarily from this financial meltdown. But the point I'm trying to make is this rapid rise of and shift of power to the East and rise of China is something we haven't seen for a very long time, certainly not at this speed. As a country that is determined to try to present a hybrid model of capitalist economy to a communist or authoritarian government, China is without question the country that's most likely to challenge the liberal or international order in the future, and thus the country that defends that order, us. So, as I said, any strategy looking forward will have to take in this fundamental shift of power from the West to the East into account as its top priority. Now, in an article you have before you, I sort of talked to a lot of people about what that strategy looked like, and I basically broke down opinions into three categories. Grand strategy light, which I think is pretty much what the Obama administration is trying to do so far, and I will talk for a second about that. Retrenchment and restore, which would be an even more serious strategic pause, while you sort of reinvigorated the foundations of your power, economic. It gets to President Obama's talks about time to do nation building here at home. And managing decline, which would be an admission that your power is declining and the goal should be to try to accommodate that in the least sort of destabilizing manner as possible. Now this is a continuum. I would argue that as I said, there's elements of all of these things in each strategy that you'll pick, and I'll talk about that for a second. But grand strategy light. I mean, clearly, when the Obama administration announced its pivot to Asia, it didn't say this, but it's pivoting away from Europe. Europeans get this. I don't know if our own public has caught wind of this. We're pulling two heavy army brigades out of Germany. We're focusing more on, maritime and naval presence in Asia. We are, getting rid of permanent bases in Europe and signing temporary basing access agreements throughout Asia, Australia, Philippines, Singapore, even Vietnam. trying to reinvigorate also our traditional alliances with Korea and Japan. Implicit in that shift is that Europe will have to bear more of the burden of policing its own backyard. Now, I can't argue that I feel very confident that Europe's up to that task, but it would have to be part of any strategy that seeks to lighten our load in a period of retrenchment. Also announced in that strategy was a cut in 100,000 ground forces, basically taking us back to pre-2001 ground force levels. Now, implicit in that cut is the message that we will not be doing any more Iraqs and Afghanistans in the foreseeable future. Secretary Gates was basically channeling Obama's thinking when he said you'd have to have you need your head examined to get involved in another manpower-intensive counterinsurgency war anywhere. That is implicit in the new 2012 National Security Strategy. It says we're no longer going to be sized for major long-term stability operations. So that's another part of grand strategy life that I think the Obama administration is representing. It also says that we're going to handle the counterterrorism mission, the terrorism threat, with discrete targeted operations by special forces and CIA drones, which are all going to be beefed up. Even as we cut down other parts of the force, they are being grown. Our drone arsenal, our special forces are growing. The template for grand strategy like would be Libya. President Obama was criticized for leading from behind in Libya, where he basically agreed to take part in the operation, but because it was not a first-tier American national interest, pressured the advocates who wanted to do this most in NATO, France, and Great Britain to take the lead in the operation and to bear a significant amount of the burden. Now, you may think that's leading from behind, but that is going to be a template for how you deal with second-order security threats in the future. You can't afford to keep this strategic free rider status, where all our allies expect every time something happens that America leads the posse. We need some other people to help lead the posse. Retrench and restore would be more of a strategic pause to restore the fundamentals of American power, as I mentioned. In an article in Foreign Affairs, The Wisdom of Retrenchment, the authors looked at 18 nations who slipped from the top rankings of most powerful nations since 1870. And in 15 cases, they adopted some form of retrenchment strategy. Half of those 15 actually recovered their former positions, including Russia in the 1880s, the United Kingdom in the early 20th century. Three declining great powers did not adopt a retrenchment strategy and never recovered, they argue. France in the 1880s, Germany in the 1930s, and Japan in the 1990s. What would a retrenchment strategy look like? I think the post-Vietnam era offers some important clues to what a retrenchment strategy would look like. As you remember, when Nixon was elected, he rapidly started a policy of Vietnamization, which basically shifted the burden to South Vietnamese forces and started withdrawing American troops. Obviously, we've seen that template used in Iraq, and we're seeing it right now in Afghanistan, which I assure you we will be out of by the end of 2014 in terms of major combat power. Nixon also announced a doctrine that we would retain our nuclear commitments and the nuclear umbrella to key allies, but we were going to demand that our Asian allies basically defend themselves. They'd be responsible for their own future. We'd help train them, we'd help equip them. We weren't going to send manpower to fight anymore. Manpower in Pennsylvania, another Vietnam. We weren't going to do that again. So again, very close echo to what I think Obama's trying to do right now. That allows you to cut ground forces, which we did in the 1970s, and to decrease forward deploy of forces in permanent bases, which we also did. Let me just mention that there's risk involved in all of these. There's increased risk involved in all of these strategies. The best strategy would be the one that Governor Romney. The most risk-free strategy from a military point of view or a national security point of view would be the one that Governor Romney described, which was 100,000 more troops, keep the 100,000 troops, increase the size of the Navy, modernize the Air Force. The problem was he could never explain how you afford that. And that is the problem, you know, of strategy. You have to balance your, you know, your risk against the resources you have to apply to those risks. Managing decline would be, as I said, an accommodation to what you believe is an inevitable drop-off in power and influence. There is an article that summarized a bunch of the studies out there about how to manage this drawdown called Strategic Adjustments to Sustain the Force. And it described a force that withdrew 50,000 forward deployed troops in Europe and Asia, cut aircraft carrier battle groups from 11 to 8, Marines amphibious strike groups from 10 to 6, cut two Air Force fighter wings, and basically pulled most troops back from forward deployments into the United States, used more as a rotational model. The problem is, obviously, and I know you guys are way ahead of me on this, on this continuum between retrench and restore and managing decline, there's a danger point where you become so weak that you invite people to test you. Arguably, that happened in the 1970s when, after a decade of drawdown, we had a hollow army and this, culminating with the Soviet Union invading Afghanistan in 79 and the Iranians taking our embassy hostage. The problem is that no one knows where is that line between the risk of retrenchment and the provocative weakness of decline lies. So, as I said at the outset, you tend to cross that line without knowing it, and you find out the hard way that you've crossed that line. So the template for managing threats in a managing decline strategy would be not Libya, but Syria. We've sat by and watched Syria civil war burn. We've watched it draw in our allies. We've watched it empower Iran, an implacable foe. And to date, we've done almost nothing. And I would argue that a lot of people would applaud that, keeping us out of another war in the Middle East. I would argue that if you look at how the trajectory Syria's on and what it means for close allies and strategic interests, like making sure there's a stable Middle East for the free flow of energy, that it's a pretty dark picture. And if that's the template you're going to draw, the world, and you're basically announcing to the world that we're not the indispensable country, we're the dispensable country, and it'll have to fend more for yourself. I don't think the international order is ready for Atlas to shrug that way. And I'm going to leave it at that and answer any questions you guys might have from that.
James, thanks very much. We'll do a series of Q&As. And if you raise your hand if you want to ask a question and tell me who you are and where you're from. But I'll ask the first question. What does America want to be? Isn't that the sort of ultimate question?
I think it's that's an easy one. America wants to be the indispensable nation. We catapulted to the top tier of world powers after World War II. We designed a global order with the IMF, with NATO, with our alliances in Asia, that basically worked so well that became we put our imprimatur of the American century on that period. That's what we want. That's what we, but the fact is, our ability to influence that sort of world order waxes and wanes, frequently depending on war. And I haven't heard anyone articulate a retrenchment or managing decline strategy, specifically because Americans don't buy it. I mean, they talk about American exceptionalism. That's the vision that most Americans have in their mind. We're this exceptional country. We are the architects of the American century. That's what we want. The problem is it's becoming difficult to shoulder those burdens based on the strategy we've adopted so far. So I think that's what America wants. I don't think we can afford it right now to the degree that we've had it in the last 20 years.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Harry Delaney from the Center for National Policy. I have kind of a fundamental problem with your thesis that's there, and briefly I'll do that with a question, is that it seems to me that neither America is in real decline. There are people who are rising, but I don't believe America is in decline. You were mentioning of course, China. The facts that I see is that China has an economy, in real terms, it's a third of ours, and is not likely, frankly, at the growth rate of its disparities of its economy to come ahead of ours in technology and finance, a lot of other things, in a likely foreseeable future. Its naval and military powers are not anything but we have. Even with the budget in the after the sequestration takes place, we will still have more money put into our defense establishment than the next 10 powers combined, including our allies. And it seems to me that when Obama's strategy is the first, I don't disagree with you, is the first probably thesis you have here, a grand strategy right. But it's a smart strategy. And I'd like you to look at that. The second element is, what is wrong as a strategy of growth and exceptionalism, of building this country again, which has come upon very hard times in the economy? And what is wrong with being exceptional in building a great country and still maintaining the ability to meet the security risks that are out there? And Obama is saying, instead of more war, let's build allies, let's build a structure which brings together other people to support us. I just came back from Europe. The Europeans are going through the same debate that we are. So the question is, why can't we have a grand strategy, smart and right, for what is the likely future types of wars? We're not going to go to war with Russia. And we're not going to go to war, let me be really frank, with China. It makes no sense for China in any case. So where is our footprint going to be better, if not a lighter and smarter one? And that exactly what we did in places like Libya, where we let the Europeans attack. The first day, you remember this, the first day of the Libya bombings, we sent more missiles, over 100 some odd missiles, into Libya to destroy their infrastructure, and then the Brits and the French took, quote, the lead. So it was light, we didn't have people on the ground, and we lost no one. I don't see that as a bad strategy in terms of American approach now in the world. Your response?
You didn't say anything I disagreed with, so let me go down a couple of your points. On Libya, I mean, I actually think that the Obama grand strategy light is smart. I think it's smart, but it's taken some added risk. There's no question about that. But it's smart because we can't, you know, as I said, you can't be strong everywhere. So you have to decide where you're going to be strong. Is China a threat to replace us? No, China's not a threat to replace us. You're absolutely right. But China, but our relative power to China is without question declining. There's no argument there. I mean, it's. Relative power to the United States has grown quite dramatically just in a very short time frame. So if you extrapolate that out 25 years, you have to worry. And as a Navy admiral told me, China doesn't need a blue water Navy to be strong all over the world, because that's not what China wants to do. China wants to dominate Asia. So it only has to be stronger than the Seventh Fleet. China is not going to supplant us as a global power, but China can make our position in Asia very, and they hope to, very uncomfortable. And they can make the one China policy and the Taiwanese issue very uncomfortable for us. If a military balance is allowed to skew there totally away from Taiwan. So I take your point. China's not a threat to replace us as a global power. It's a threat to our position in Asia, and will become an increasing threat to our position in Asia, which is why we're pivoting to Asia. So we're responding to this, and I think that's also very smart. I think we needed to pivot to Asia. On Libya, I totally agree. I think that is a very smart template. I think there has been a strategic free rider syndrome within NATO that they expect us to lead every operation and shoulder the overwhelming burden of every operation, and we've got to get away from that free rider syndrome. So I agree, Libya should be the template. I don't agree that Syria should be the template, where we just basically let it burn and do nothing. I think that's a bad template. But I'm with you on everything else you said. I think what they're doing is smart. What I'm trying to point out is there's risk to every strategy, and the risk to their strategy is what is grand strategy like beginning becomes managing decline in the end, because, as I said, we are in a period of retrenchment. We are in a period where it's gonna be very difficult politically to sustain the robust defense budgets that Obama has proposed with a $500 billion cut over the next 10 years. I can almost assure you there'll be more cuts from that coming out of the next deal. So I'm just saying that there are risks there. Let's be clear-eyed about what they are. But I don't disagree with anything you said.
As a follow-on to that, isn't it more important then that we actually start to make decisions now of what our forces should be in the future? And isn't the very good example of what happened in the Senate yesterday with the treaty forming, that you know, we need a bipartisan consensus to make these decisions.
You say. Yeah, and that's why you develop a strategy, whether it's, you know, a lot of what I said about Grand Strategy Light is exactly what the Obama administration is doing, but they don't say it because it's not popular to sort of say you're in a sort of retrenchment mode, even though, if you'll notice, an interesting piece yesterday about General Petraeus, Fox was encouraging him to run for president, and they got, and someone, a journalist got a taped talk between him and this journalist from Fox, and he said, I'm going to the CIA because that's a growth industry. The military is in a period of retrenchment. I mean, here's the greatest strategic mind of his generation of military officers saying exactly this. We're in a period of retrenchment. Let's admit that. Let's try to do it smartly like we've talked about, and understand that it's not all about trying to make an already worn thin military do constantly more with less, but it's about doing less with less and doing it smarter, doing it in different ways. You know, there was a Senator Tom Coburn, a Republican, I think from Oklahoma, had a very interesting report recently where it says, let's get rid of all these military schools stateside. Why are we have, you know, 16 military installations with their own Defense Department schools? You know, does that make sense? Why not have them go to school in their local communities? I mean, it makes sense when you're overseas and you're in Germany and they don't speak the language. It doesn't make that much sense here. So you need to start, I think you need a strategy to say, we can't do everything all at once, and so here's where we're willing to take more risks. And the risk in that strategy is you have an economy of force presence in Latin America, in Africa, you leave it to your European allies who are slashing their own defense budgets to police the European backyard. That could lead to some disastrous effects. But you have to take that risk if you want to pivot to Asia in a period of restrained resources. So, yeah, you need to strategically understand where you're going before you're going to start shaping the force. You know, the first sign of them doing that, though, is saying we're going to cut 100,000 ground forces. That's key. And I suspect that's not the last cut of ground forces you'll see, because if you're not going to get involved in major manpower-intensive counterinsurgency campaigns, you know, the really only viable driver of a big land war is South Korea still. And the South Koreans can be pressured to put more of their own skin in the ground game as we shift more to, you know, air power and naval power in that conflict. So that is, I think, where we're heading. But to do that, you need to have a pretty clear strategic idea of what you're doing, because there are more risks. There are things you couldn't do if you couldn't invade Iran and secure all its nuclear weapons if it gets one. I mean, you just can't do that with the ground force size like they're going to do. There are things you cannot do, but that's what, you know, strategy is all about, is assuming risk in one place and maximizing, you know, your deterrent in another place.
Matt Freer, I'm a fellow here at ASP, principally writing on Somalia, which arguably is a very good example of sort of the grand strategy light you're talking about, in terms of projecting US interests and objectives through sort of other means. One of the means sort of you mentioned early on in terms of, you know, sort of change from Cold War era to post is the sort of objective of democracy and the projection of democracy and trying to spread democracy as a sort of soft power tool for supporting America's objectives. Do you think that's been working over the past 10 years?
Well, I think it's been adopted by every president I can think of. Now, they just do it differently. I don't think it works to impose it at the end of a gun. I don't think couching an invasion of another country as a democratic crusade is a very good way to go about it. But when you see Obama trying to get the right side of all those Arab Spring movements by saying Mubarak must go, by trying to help Libya get rid of Gaddafi, that's a spread of democracy strategy at work. He's just doing it in a much more restrained fashion, much less skin in the game, and I think probably smarter, because, you know, the spread of democracy, to me, it's fundamental to our values, it's fundamental to what makes us exceptional, it's also fundamental to our strategy, because that world of democracies is one where we can finally lay down some of these burdens, because we don't fight with democracies. So it's a net good thing, but you don't do it, I think, by sort of, it's not our responsibility. It's the same you know, a founding father said on entangling alliances, we, you know, support democratic movements, sometimes economically, sometimes just with our goodwill. We press undemocratic countries to become more liberal and democratic, as we constantly do with human rights issues in China, et cetera. So I think that we will always be part of our strategic DNA to look positively on the spread of democracy and free markets, et cetera, liberal values. But do I think that it's our responsibility to go out there and enforce that? No, I do not. And I think we've seen over the last decade how much trouble that can get you into.
Sam Brown, I'm an adjunct here today to speak. I want to pick up on this exchange a little bit because I think it possibly doesn't highlight the extent to which Obama's strategy right is discontinuous with what the military was preparing itself for, particularly after 2001 and in Iraq and Afghanistan. The military has trained a whole new generation of officers to do counterinsurgency under the Petraeus model, which is really to transform societies, not simply to favor democracy, but to have the military be a principal instrument of that. That's what counterinsurgency is. In the strategic division published last year, as you pointed out, counterinsurgency and stability operations are severely downgraded. And what it looks like is that the United States, after a long period of experimentation after World War II and the Cold War, is now rejecting a quasi-imperialistic role for itself. Certainly, it's rejecting it to the extent that it will involve the military as a major instrument. That's fundamental, it appears to me. It's discontinuous, and I wonder if you have any reaction.
I mean, the military throughout the Cold War, and I would argue throughout the 1990s, really had a warfighting model of conventional war. They, you know, ever since Vietnam, they've just rejected counterinsurgency and left it to the special forces, basically, which is a small sliver of the military. And that makes sense in the world of nation state versus nation state conflict, you know, which is what I think we're going to see less of. And they're coming to grips with, okay, if we're not going to, I mean, you're right, there's a generation of officers who know nothing but counterinsurgency, but that's why, you know, it's in the infinite wisdom of the founding fathers, they put civilians in charge of the military. And the civilians are sending a very clear message to the military, and it's written in the doctrine. You will not be size four, so do not anticipate large-scale counterinsurgency, nation-building, stability operations. We're not going to be doing them for the foreseeable future. What that tells me is if you are going to get involved in the counterinsurgency, much like we did with Libya, or much like we may in Syria, it's going to be proxy. You're going to we're training indigenous forces all over the world. We're training them in Africa, we're training them in the Philippines, we got special forces on our drones looking at counterterrorism in the Philippines. The model there is kind of early 1960s before you did the ramp up to Vietnam, which is we will train proxies, we'll put skin in the game, but it's only, you're gonna be the people on the tip of the spear, you know, and I think we'll see this if friends, you know, counterinsurgency is not just when you invade and regime change, you have friends who may be facing insurgencies who you want to help. The help's not going to be sending in the 82nd Airborne. The help's going to be sending in special forces and helping them and train and equip their own indigenous forces to handle the threat themselves. That's been the Somalian model, the African Union Force, and we've been enabling them very quietly, but that's the response we took, you know, enable proxies, essentially, just like we're about to, I think, probably start enabling the Syrian rebels. We're definitely training them and giving them some communications help. We're going to probably help them with arms. It's proxy. It's lighter footprint. You know, the downside of that is, quite honestly, is what you saw in Libya, is that even when you're successful, you have much less influence to influence the direction those societies take. But, you know, that's the risk you have to assume if you're not going to do these large-scale counterinsurgencies. And I think it's a risk we will be assuming.
Can I just follow on that? Our policy of Vietnamization did not really work. The proxies that we trained were not successful. In Iraq, it's not clear that those that we, quote, trained are not going to be fighting each other that much. Afghanistan is a huge question mark as to whether or not we are able to actually effectively rely on proxies to pursue our interests. Somalia is up for grabs, I would grant you that. but it appears to me that this notion that somehow we can transfer and transmute our responsibilities to others to do it effectively deserves a good deal of skepticism.
I suppose it also is about how we train and how we help our proxies. As we see in Somalia, we're not training to use the M16. They have Kalashnikovs that they can use.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you only act if it's in your strategic interest, national interest, to act. And if you don't think that you have any skin in the game, which we don't in the Congo, for instance, or we didn't in Rwanda, then you just let the thing go. But if you decide you have a national interest, and we decided that in Vietnam, and I don't want to refight Vietnam. We fought that war as the first four or five years as a search and destroy, almost seek and kill kind of tactics that were not very good for counterinsurgency. A lot of people I talked to from Vietnam argue that Congress hadn't pulled the money out and we pulled our air power out, Vietnam might have been able to stand up. We'll never know. Iraq, you know, the military thinks Iraq was kind of on balance a net plus, considering where we found ourselves. And, you know, the argument there might be never to invade Iraq in the first place. But once you invade it, you're faced with insurgency. We did have national interests at play then. I think we had little choice but to try to, you know, not let it devolve into a civil war that fractured Iraq into three different pieces and probably drew the country, you know, the neighbors in. Somalia, we decided we had very little skin in that game after the Black Hawk Down incident in 2001. So we've been very, you know, we haven't gone into Somalia except for some CIA guys. We've trained them, you know, from afar, the African Union forces, to do that. You know, if it doesn't work, again, it's not like something that's going to be pulling Americans off the roof of an embassy. It's, we figured, what I'm saying is I think that you design what counterinsurgency help you want to give commensurate with what you think your national interests are in each case. And I think that's what we've done. I think we've got, probably about right in Libya and probably wrong in Syria. I think we have greater interest in Syria than would imply that you just sit back there and let that thing burn, even as it empowers and emboldens our own.
Hi, I'm Joshua Faust. I'm a fellow at ASP. I'm curious if you could maybe dig in a little bit deeper to this new imperative with security assistance. I mean, the successful models that you're drawing on most recently on Libya weren't actually examples of us assisting a government to defend itself, but rather us arming an insurgency to topple the government. It's the opposite of COIN, essentially, which I think we have a pretty decent record in succeeding at. The challenge that I see looking at the future, I mean, I agree with you that that's where a lot of the defense thinking is, the future is in security assistance. But that, I think Sam was putting his finger on it, that we do have kind of a fraught record of that. Even in places like Yemen, which is a pretty strong model for how people want to handle this kind of hybrid type assistance in the future. The forces that we are assisting have a really hard time performing basic tasks. Once they've secured territory, they run into the exact same problems we ran into in both Iraq and Afghanistan, where they didn't know what to replace the insurgency with. They didn't have a functioning government. They didn't have the ability to provide services or repair infrastructure. So then what do? All they can do is occupy an area. It seems like we're still missing in this big picture about what to do with limited force and with limited means and limited interests. How to actually balance that right? I mean, I'm curious if you think it's maybe just adapting less maximalist goals, if it's coming up with some new process for being able to deliver these kinds of outcomes that seem really essential to success in these kinds of operations. But I mean, it seems like there's still a really critical missing part of that equation. Somalia is a good example of this too. The government hasn't quite figured out how to fill the gap that the ICU used to fill. They've displaced them, but they haven't figured out how to really fill in the vacuum that's behind. So,
well,
to
stay with Somalia, I mean, if you thought that we needed to make sure that the government that we help put in place, that UN-sanctioned government forces, are successful, then we'd send in troops. But we don't think we have interest commensurate with sending in troops. So all we're willing to do is help them, and we do some democracy promotion. And the State Department has little pots of money they can nudge and help. But we have not determined that democracy in Somalia is a big enough national interest to actually put feet in the ground and make that happen. I mean, what got me in the Iraq War, when President Bush said, you know, my father came to me and talked about how after World War II, you know, we fought the Germans and the Japanese and now they're our best friends. And that was his sort of model for democracy, as if no one told him that we still have tens of thousands of troops in Germany and Japan a half century later. And if you're willing to do that, you can ensure a democratic outcome. If you basically take responsibility for Somalia or Yemen, if you want to do that, you know, you can assure success, but you will also ensure that you'll be a declining power from strategic overextension. So what I'm saying is, in each case, you have to weigh what's your national interest, how much skin you want to put in the game. You know, I would argue that, you know, we were pretty successful in the Philippines in helping them confront an insurgency. I would argue we were pretty successful in Iraq. We had a lot of skin in that game, that we had, you know, 100,000 plus troops. You know, I would argue we did what we were willing to do with Libya, and it worked. Gaddafi's gone. You know, I think the application of marrying rebellions or insurgents to our air power is very powerful, if you're willing to go that far. But that's certainly a much larger step than just arming them. That's actually fighting that's actually being their air force. So in each of these cases, you have all these tools, and you'll have to decide. Now, I mean, I don't know why Yemen particularly is a cautionary tale. We are operating drones in Yemen with the okay of the Yemeni government, and Yemen's got problems as a lot of post-Arab Spring countries have, but I think our intelligence community thinks that those operations have been pretty successful. We've taken out Anwar al-Awlaki and some others. That to me is a light footprint, you know, special forces drone heavy kind of thing that you'll be seeing a lot more of, because the alternative, again, is to put a lot more skin in the game than not only we have the appetite for, but really can afford right now.
As a final question, it's clear that American national security strategy and its position is changing. How do we move from some of the weapons and the thinking that we have from the Cold War into what we now need?
Well, I mean, you're seeing that already too. I mean, I mentioned a couple of places, but I mean the network, of which the most obvious element is the tip of the spear of the drone. We have invested huge amounts of money in the network, you know, which is a globe-spanning surveillance and reconnaissance apparatus that has these drones at the pointy end of the tip of the spear. We're investing heavily in that. You probably saw the CIA's recently announced massively increasing its drone arsenal. The drone arsenal for the military is going to be increased. Special forces is going to be increased. There's already talk about reducing the nuclear strategic arsenal as a way to save money. I think you'll probably see something like that. It'll certainly be proposed. I think, I don't know if the Congress will bite. The pivot to Asia involves a blue water Navy. So you won't see cuts in the Navy. You won't commensurate with the Army and the Marine Corps. You probably aren't going to see cuts in the Air Force, because it's also an air power intensive theater. And air power, quite honestly, is the thing. Precision air power is our ace in the hole. The drones are that, but so in Libya, we are better at that than anyone else in the world. And it's the kind of thing that plays our strength. Technology, not manpower intensive, can do it without a whole lot of casualties, which are difficult. I think that's the kind of force they're confronting. And if you're someone who wants to worry, you worry if you're in the Army that, I don't think you're going to see a brand new tank anytime soon. I think we're going to be keeping refurbishing A1s, M1s forever, you know, for another 10 years, 15 years. I don't think you're going to see wide-scale replacement of this generation. I think you're going to see upgrades with a few, you know, again, with where you're seeing next generation, typically it's aircraft, and in some degree, maybe ships, not ground systems. And I think that's kind of the future we're looking at in the next 10, 15 years.
This has been absolutely fascinating. James, thank you so much.
Happy to do it. Thanks for coming out.